BBC World Service. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is about to step down as Iran's president. His two terms in office are up. I'm James Reynolds, the BBC's Iran correspondent, with this look back at his time in power. Ahmadinejad, the populist, and the pariah.
Who is this man? Is he really of extreme views, almost unbalanced views?
There are many positive points to be made about Ahmadinejad. His love of the people, his nationalism.
Did we ever get him? Did we ever really understand him?
No, we didn't.
The crowd is getting very excited. President Ahmadinejad is just putting on a cloak, which is a symbol of majesty here. It's multicolored, yellow and red, and he's taken off his jacket. And on goes the cloak, to the great delight of the crowd around me.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad will go almost anywhere in search of an audience. Here, the cheers come not from Tehran, but from Accra, Ghana. Iran's president may be a pariah in Washington, but elsewhere, he's worshipped as a hero.
Hey, you guys, what did you say?
Yeah, we love him. We love him. We love him. We love him.
Why?
We love him.
Why?
We love him.
Why?
We love him.
Why don't you like him? Why don't you like him?
We love his people. We love him.
So how did a local politician in Iran with a doctorate in traffic management become a superstar or a supervillain? Did the West overestimate the threat posed by an opportunist with little actual power? In this BBC programme, I'll be looking at the two sides of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the populist and the pariah. Iran is ruled for life by its supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. But every 4 years, the country chooses a president, an office with plenty of exposure, but little ultimate power. In 2005, the mayor of Tehran decided that he could make more of this job than anyone before him. Ahmadinejad didn't much look like a potential president. He wore a cheap jacket and a scruffy beard. This made the middle class cringe, and that was the point. He was after the votes of the little guy, the farmers and taxi drivers of Iran's working class. Photographer Hassan Sarbakshian covered Ahmadinejad's final campaign rallies.
I hurt my knee, so I could barely move. In fact, the doctor had ordered me to rest, but I didn't want to miss that moment. The room was full. It was chaos. Because of my knee injury, I had to stand quite far back, so you could hardly see his face in the pictures I took of him. He's quite short. I was really annoyed, so when he walked towards me, I shouted at him, "Is this how you're going to manage the country?" He looked at me and said, "You can see, it's out of my hand. I'm nobody here." When the results came out the next morning, I thought, "Oh no, who did I shout at? What should I do now?" We just couldn't believe at the time that he'd become president.
The White House, too, struggled to make sense of Iran's new president. Steve Hadley was George W. Bush's national security advisor.
What you get when you're in the White House is you got a lot of different views and a lot of different strands of who this man is. It is very difficult, even with someone that American officials might have spent a lot of time with, to make judgments. This was a figure, of course, that for a variety of reasons the American officials had not spent any time with. So the answer is you really don't know.
But there was one strong early clue at Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's endorsement after his election. The supreme leader embraced the president, then left the stage. Ahmadinejad stayed to enjoy the crowd until the leader's bodyguards bundled him away. Farhad Jafari is an author and one of Ahmadinejad's most prominent supporters inside Iran.
All the presidents before Ahmadinejad were dependent upon Iran's ruling class. But Ahmadinejad was a man of the people. Unlike his predecessors, he understood ordinary Iranians, and he was more committed to the people than he was to the political ruling class.
Ahmadinejad needed to find a quick way of showing this. He settled on the country's nuclear program. He'd inherited a uranium enrichment freeze agreed with European negotiators. Days after Ahmadinejad took office, Iran ended the deal. The White House held the new president responsible. Former National Security Advisor Steve Hadley again.
The negotiated solution, which through the EU3 leadership we had obtained, he basically reversed and became, within the Iranian political system, probably the most visible advocate of the nuclear program as somehow the essence of Iranian sovereignty. And I think we thought was sort of dragged along initially a rather reluctant supreme leader. And the supreme leader may have learned from that example that the nuclear program could be, in some sense, an element of support for the supreme leader among the population, because Ahmadinejad was really the one who wedded that program as somehow the essence of Iranian sovereignty and pride.
But to one former insider, that is a significant misreading of what happened. In 2005, Hossein Mousavian was a senior member of Iran's nuclear negotiating team. He argues that in the run-up to that year, the West had failed to match a number of Iranian concessions.
Just some months before election 2005, I personally told very clearly, very openly, to my EU3 interlocutors, regardless of who would be elected as president, Iran would restart enrichment.
And it did. Hossein Mousavian was then called into the new president's office for a 2.5-hour meeting. Ahmadinejad asked Mousavian to be his foreign minister. Mousavian turned down the offer. The two men saw the world in different ways. Mousavian says that he always knew that the West would not stand by if Iran restarted its nuclear program. But Ahmadinejad believed that the West would do nothing.
He had no fear. No fear. He said, we would start and they would be able to do nothing. That's it. That's it. This is your mistake. They cannot do anything. I was really shocked. He was so brave or inexperienced. I mean, he clearly didn't give a damn to United Nations Security Council to decide on Iranian nuclear issue. They cannot do anything.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. All praise be to Allah, the Lord of the universe, and peace and blessing be upon our Master and Prophet Muhammad.
Ahmadinejad addressed the UN General Assembly in New York on several occasions. He enjoyed it. On his first visit, EU foreign ministers struggled to arrange an appointment with Iran's new president. Jack Straw was the British Foreign Secretary.
What was the meeting like?
Well, it was different. I think President Ahmadinejad was feeling his way internationally. I think that he was very suspicious of the way his predecessor had handled international relations, and they were defining themselves against the reformist president.
But the meeting produced no agreement. Jack Straw, from Britain's left-of-centre Labour Party, believes that the unwillingness to make any concessions to the Iranians was driven by right-wing elements in both the US and Israel.
The neocons got what they wished for, and so did the Israeli right wing. It's been, in my view, a pretty poor chapter of relations and a good example of how not to deal with a country. And there's been an absence of statesmanship.
Israel began to watch Iran's new president closely. It was shocked by his words. In October 2005, Ahmadinejad called for Israel to vanish from the page of time. Ahmadinejad had no immediate power to put these words into action. He did not control Iran's armed forces, nor did he have the final say on the country's nuclear program. but his enemies listened anyway. Yuval Steinitz is Israel's intelligence minister.
Yeah, I think we have to consider it very seriously. The natural tendency of people is to try to underestimate such threats. You don't want to deal with them. You don't want to spend money on preparing yourself to the threats. You are focused on other problems. It's difficult to live with such a threat. So you usually convince yourself, this is just rhetoric. It's for domestic purposes. It doesn't mean it, but the same things were said when Churchill warned against Hitler. People said it doesn't mean it, it's just for domestic purposes. It's just rhetoric.
But was this a mistake? Was it just rhetoric? Did everyone take Ahmadinejad too seriously? During the Ahmadinejad years, US Ambassador Ryan Crocker led a series of direct talks with Iranian officials. He has engaged with Iran more than any other U.S. official in three decades.
I really do believe that we have taken Ahmadinejad far more seriously than he deserves. And he loves it. He loves being outrageous. He loves drawing fire from all corners of the civilized world. But, you know, I don't think it really counts for very much in the Iranian policy sphere.
But Ahmadinejad believed in dramatic gestures which exceeded his powers. Like many politicians, he also believed he could persuade anybody of his point of view. In 2006, he decided to do what no Iranian president before him had done for a quarter of a century: send a letter to the President of the United States.
Mr. George Bush, President of the United States of America. For some time now, I have been thinking how one can justify the undeniable contradictions that exist in the international arena.
The letter was long, very long, 18 pages long. It discussed religious and political history and the relationship between Iran and the United States.
Mr. President, how much longer can the world tolerate this situation? How much longer will the blood of the innocent men, women and children be spilled on the streets?
President Bush's national security adviser, Steve Hadley, had to decide how to respond.
It was a rambling letter, and when the question came up, well, shall we reply to the letter? One of the problems was it's hard to know what to reply to. It was just a sort of a rambling sort of stream of consciousness. And secondly, this was a man who was already embodying policies that were very abhorrent to us and to the rest of the international community. Do you really want to respond to a leader who writes you this stream of conscious letter, who's pursuing policies very antithetical to the interests of stability and peace in the region, when everybody knows also that the real decision maker is the supreme leader?
So Mahmoud Ahmadinejad didn't get a reply. Former nuclear negotiator Hossein Mousavian believes this was a missed opportunity.
It was a big humiliation, not only to Ahmadinejad, to Iran. It was Iranian president who wrote the letter. And I always complain to Americans that you made a big mistake. He was Iranian president. He took the initiative. He came to you by official letters. You should have responded. You should not have humiliated him.
But it was not in Ahmadinejad's nature to be put off. He continued to build himself a world stage by provoking and engaging with the West. He told an American audience that, unlike in the States, there were no gay people in Iran. He also suggested that he would like to visit Ground Zero. Steve Hadley again.
Ahmadinejad made some statements at the time of 9/11, which suggested, as I recall, that either the United States or Israel or some combination of the two was behind the 9/11 tragedy. And why would you want to give someone who has publicly articulated that view the forum of coming to 9/11 to spew that kind of nonsense? How could any president agree to do that? So, of course, we refused to give him that forum.
A diplomatic crisis has erupted after 15 British servicemen were seized at gunpoint by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard while on patrol in the Gulf. The Foreign Office is demanding their immediate and safe return.
But in March 2007, Ahmadinejad found himself with another chance to take the stage. Iran captured 15 British Marines and sailors. It accused them of straying into Iran's own waters. Joe Tyndall, one of those held, remembers being lined up against the wall with some of the other Marines.
And I remember sort of like guns getting cocked and things like that, and I sort of thought the worst at the time. One of the fellows that always stick in my mind, he was on one end, and I remember him shouting out, lads, I'm going to get executed, and I could hear some sort of commotion of him getting dragged away.
After 13 days, the Marines were told they were going to be released. Joe Tyndall and his colleagues were given new suits to wear.
We were all sat around, and he just said, we're going to release you as an Easter gift to the Western world or something like that. And I didn't really believe anything I was told, because we were sort of treated, in my opinion, quite badly while we were there. And then they came round and said, oh, the President of Iran is going to be coming and you're going to meet him. And I remember sort of thinking, it's a bit of a sort of sideshow for TV, and I just wanted to go home.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad occupied his usual position, centre stage. He may not have had anything to do with the sailors and Marines' capture, or indeed their release, but he took advantage of all the attention anyway. He even featured it in his re-election campaign. During his 2009 re-election campaign, Ahmadinejad tried to show that 4 years in power had not changed him. He was still a member of the working class. In one video, he showed viewers round his small house. He even did the weeding. He wanted more power for his own form of populist nationalism. It was a challenge to the clerics. The prominent Ahmadinejad loyalist Farhad Jafari cheered him on.
There are many positive points to be made about Ahmadinejad. His love of the people, his nationalism. He brought Iran's flag back to life. Before, if you passed bank buildings or the ministries, you felt ashamed by the flags on display. They were old, dirty, and neglected. But Ahmadinejad valued national symbols like the flag, and under him, they appeared in many more places.
But Ahmadinejad didn't have all that much to show for his 4 years in office. The UN and the West responded to the restarting of Iran's nuclear program with several rounds of sanctions. The toughest would eventually hit Iran's oil exports, the country's most vital source of income. Unemployment rose rapidly, the currency plummeted, food prices rose steadily. Inside Iran in 2009, many blamed Ahmadinejad for chronic mismanagement of the economy. They were after real change. The opposition Green Movement and its leaders Mir Hussein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi wanted reform. But the Supreme Leader did not. He ruled that Ahmadinejad had won re-election. Mohammad Reza Jalaipur, a family friend of Ahmadinejad's, was jailed for campaigning for the opposition. He spent several months in solitary confinement.
After the election, we asked supporters of Mousavi to chant Allahu Akbar under the roofs of their houses every night as a sign of protest to the results, and people welcomed it. I was in prison, but we could hear the sounds of Allahu Akbar all over Tehran for a few days, if not months.
But the cries came to nothing. The Supreme Leader and the powerful Revolutionary Guard had made sure that Ahmadinejad would serve another 4 years in office. Tahi Karoubi is the son of one of the opposition leaders, Mehdi Karoubi.
Ahmadinejad received a huge support from the Revolutionary Guard. He came to the power. By that time, Ahmadinejad was just a puppet. But the system gave him an opportunity to present himself inside and outside of the country.
Ahmadinejad decided to take this opportunity almost immediately. At the start of his second term, he made the most dangerous decision of his presidency. He would defy his own supreme leader. Ahmadinejad appointed as vice president his close ally Isfandiar Rahim Mashai, a man who had dared to criticize traditionalist clerics. It was an appointment which revealed Ahmadinejad's ambitions for his final term. Tahir Karoubi again.
He began to promote nationalists or renew the relation with the West, or also play an important role in Iranian negotiation over the Iranian nuclear program. I think Ahmadinejad realized this fact. His time is over. His mission is over. He needs the people instead of the system.
But the system proved to be more powerful than the president. The supreme leader vetoed the appointment of Rahim Mashai as vice president, and the Ayatollah began to go after Ahmadinejad's circle. In Tehran's notorious Evin prison, Mohammad Reza Jalaipur began to notice some surprising new arrivals.
One of the porters had bad hearing. So when he was the porter, I used to talk with the people who were in the next cell. And I figured out that they are supporters of Ahmadinejad. They were absolutely surprised to be in prison.
Surprised indeed. 4 years earlier, it would have been inconceivable for supporters of Ahmadinejad to be locked up. In 2011, the fight between leader and president reached its peak. The Ayatollah overruled the president's decision to sack the intelligence minister. Ahmadinejad responded by sulking. He stayed away from work for 11 days. He even began to reflect upon the fate of the opposition Green Movement leaders, Mir Hussein Mousavi and Mehdi Karoubi, who were both under house arrest on the supreme leader's orders. Tahir Karoubi heard that the president tried to intervene on his father's behalf.
We've been told Ahmadinejad wrote a letter to supreme leader asked to free the political prisoner and remove the house arrest of the opposition leader. Is it right or wrong? We don't know.
Whether or not he actually did send this letter, some drew a simple conclusion. If Mahmoud Ahmadinejad wasn't with the clerics, he must be with the reformers. So could the man elected as a conservative really have been a reformer all along? Former US Ambassador Ryan Crocker disagrees strongly.
I do not for a moment buy the notion that Ahmadinejad is a secret reformer standing steadfast against these wild-eyed clerics. It's hard to exceed Ahmadinejad in the wild-eyed department. But I'm not sure we really even need to ask the question whether he harbors reform tendencies or not, because looking at the Iranian system, the capacity of the president to materially alter policy, whether foreign and domestic, is extremely limited.
President Bush's national security advisor, Steve Hadley, agrees. He says that despite all the headlines Ahmadinejad has grabbed over the past 8 years, his departure may not lead to any real change.
Ahmadinejad has pursued policies, rhetoric, and actions contrary to our interests, no question about that. But the supreme leader has now embraced a lot of those. So if Ahmadinejad disappears from the scene, great. We don't know who will succeed him, what policies they will pursue, and in any event, it doesn't solve the problem of the supreme leader, who, after all, is the head of this regime, and the supreme leader does not leave on June 14th.
On recent tour in Ghana, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad enjoyed the stage he'd spent the last 8 years building. But what, in the end, was there to show for it? The BBC put this to him directly.
Despite all the unfair pressures exerted on the people of Iran, we are making headway very fast. Before the recent sanctions of the Western countries, my country only produced 32 million tons of cement. But today we are producing more than 80 million tons of cement. And since the day they imposed sanctions on us, we have gone nuclear. And now we are making use of peaceful nuclear energy. When they imposed sanctions on us, we became a country that has launched satellites into space. The pressures have created problems for us, but they have never been able to bring our progress to a halt.
Shalom al-Fahwash.
All the best.
During his 8 years in office, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was both populist and pariah. He enjoyed fame, but not power. He provoked both the West and Iran's clerics, but he won neither fight. Earlier this year, he suggested that he would be willing to become the first Iranian in space. No doubt, that would gain him yet more headlines. But down here on Earth, he's about to lose what he loves above all else, his stage. This is the BBC. You've been listening to The Populist and the Pariah with me, James Reynolds.